and Dr. Merryman. Now, you and I may have the services of Dr. Merryman free every hour of the day by keeping our attention fixed on all the incredible riches we possess, riches exceeding by far the fabled treasures of Alibaba. Would you sell both your eyes for $1 billion? What would you take for your two legs? Your hands, your hearing, your children, your family? Add up your assets, and you will find that you won't sell what you have for all the gold ever amassed by the Rockefellers, the Fords, and the Morgans combined. But do we appreciate all this? Ah, no. As Schopenhauer said, we seldom think of what we have, but always of what we lack. Yes, the tendency to seldom think of what we have, but always of what we lack, is the greatest tragedy on earth. It has probably caused more misery than all the wars and diseases in history. It caused John Palmer to turn from a regular guy into an old grouch and almost wreck his home. I know, because he told me so. Mr. Palmer lives in Paterson, New Jersey. Shortly after I returned from the Army, he said, I started in business for myself. I worked hard day and night. Things were going nicely. Then trouble started. I couldn't get parts and materials. I was afraid I would have to give up my business. I worried so much that I changed from a regular guy into an old grouch. I became so sour and cross that, well, I didn't know it then, but I now realize that I came very near to losing my happy home. Then one day a young disabled veteran who works for me said, Johnny, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. You take on as if you were the only person in the world with troubles. Suppose you do have to shut up shop for a while. So what? You can start up again when things get normal. You've got a lot to be thankful for. Yet you're always growling. Boy, how I wish I were in your shoes. Look at me. I've only got one arm and half of my face is shot away, and yet I'm not complaining. If you don't stop your growling and grumbling, you'll lose not only your business, but also your health, your home, and your friends. Those remarks stopped me dead in my tracks. They made me realize how well off I was. I resolved then and there that I would change and be my old self again. And I did. A friend of mine, Lucille Blake, had to tremble on the edge of tragedy before she learned to be happy about what she had instead of worrying over what she lacked. I met Lucille years ago when we were both studying short story writing in the Columbia University School of Journalism. Some years ago, she got the shock of her life. She was living then in Tucson, Arizona. She had, well, here's the story as she told it to me. I had been living in a whirl, studying the organ at the University of Arizona, conducting a speech clinic in town, and teaching a class in musical appreciation at the Desert Willow Ranch where I was staying. I was going in for parties, dances, horseback rides under the stars. One morning I collapsed, my heart. You'll have to lie in bed for a year of complete rest, the doctor said. He didn't encourage me to believe I would ever be strong again. In bed for a year, to be an invalid, perhaps to die, I was terror-stricken. Why did all this have to happen to me? What had I done to deserve it? I wept and wailed. I was bitter and rebellious. But I did go to bed as the doctor advised. A neighbor of mine, Mr. Rudolph, an artist, said to me, You think now that spending a year in bed will be a tragedy, but it won't be. You'll have the time to think and get acquainted with yourself. You'll make more spiritual growth in these next few months than you've made during all your previous life. I became calmer and tried to develop a new sense of values. I read books of inspiration. One day I heard a radio commentator say, You can express only what is in your own consciousness. I had heard words like these many times before, but now they reached down inside me and took root. I resolved to think only the thoughts I wanted to live by, thoughts of joy, happiness, health. I forced myself each morning, as soon as I awoke, to go over all the things I had to be grateful for. No pain, a lovely young daughter, my eyesight, my hearing, lovely music on the radio, time to read, good food, good friends. I was so cheerful and had so many visitors that the doctor put up a sign saying that only one visitor at a time would be allowed in my cabin, and only at certain hours. Many years have passed since then, and I now lead a full, active life. I'm deeply grateful now for that year I spent in bed. It was the most valuable and the happiest year I spent in Arizona. the habit I formed then of counting my blessings each morning still remains with me. It is one of my most precious possessions. I'm ashamed to realize that I never really learned to live until I feared I was going to die. My dear Lucille Blake, you may not realize it, but you learned the same lesson that Dr. Samuel Johnson learned 200 years ago. The habit of looking on the best side of every event, said Dr. Johnson, is worth more than £1,000 a year. Those words were uttered, mind you, not by a professional optimist, but by a man who had known anxiety, rags, and hunger for 20 years, and finally became one of the most eminent writers of his generation and the most celebrated conversationalist of all time. Logan Pearsall Smith packed a lot of wisdom into a few words when he said, "There are two things to aim at in life. First, to get what you want, and after that, to enjoy it. Only the wisest of mankind achieve the second." Would you like to know how to make even dishwashing at the kitchen sink a thrilling experience? If so, read an inspiring book of incredible courage by Borghild Dahl. It is called I Wanted to See. This book was written by a woman who was practically blind for half a century. "I had only one eye," she writes, "and it was so covered with dense scars that I had to do all my seeing through one small opening in the left of the eye. I could see a book only by holding it up close to my face and by straining my one eye as hard as I could to the left." But she refused to be pitied, refused to be considered different. As a child, she wanted to play hopscotch with other children, but she couldn't see the markings. So after the other children had gone home, she got down on the ground and crawled along with her eyes near to the marks. She memorized every bit of the ground where she and her friends played, and soon became an expert at running games. She did her reading at home, holding a book of large print so close to her eyes that her eyelashes brushed the pages. She earned 2 college degrees, an A.B. from the University of Minnesota and a Master of Arts from Columbia University. She started teaching in the tiny village of Twin Valley, Minnesota, and rose until she became Professor of Journalism and Literature at Augustana College in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. She taught there for 13 years, lecturing before women's clubs and giving radio talks about books and authors. "In the back of my mind," she writes, "there had always lurked a fear of total blindness. In order to overcome this, I had adopted a cheerful, almost hilarious attitude toward life." Then in 1943, when she was 52 years old, a miracle happened, an operation at the famous Mayo Clinic. She could now see 40 times as well as she had ever been able to see before. A new and exciting world of loveliness opened before her. She now found it thrilling even to wash dishes in the kitchen sink. "I began to play with the white fluffy suds in the dishpan," she writes. "I dip my hands into them, and I pick up a ball of tiny soap bubbles. I hold them up against the light, and in each of them I can see brilliant colors of a miniature rainbow." As she looked through the windows above the kitchen sink, she saw the flapping gray-black wings of the sparrows flying through the thick, falling snow. She found such ecstasy looking at the soap bubbles and sparrows that she closed her book with these words, "Dear Lord, I whisper, Our Father in heaven, I thank Thee. I thank Thee." Imagine thanking God because you can wash dishes and see rainbows and bubbles and sparrows flying through the snow. You and I ought to be ashamed of ourselves. All the days of our years we have been living in a fairyland of beauty, but we have been too blind to see, too satiated to enjoy. If we want to stop worrying and start living, rule 4 is, count your blessings, not your troubles. Chapter 16. Find yourself and be yourself. Remember, there is no one else on earth like you. I have a letter from Mrs. Edith Allred of Mount Airy, North Carolina. As a child, I was extremely sensitive and shy, she says in her letter. I was always overweight, and my cheeks made me look even fatter than I was. I had an old-fashioned mother who thought it was foolish to make clothes look pretty. She always said, "Wide will wear, while narrow will tear," and she dressed me accordingly. I never went to parties, never had any fun, and when I went to school, I never joined the other children in outside activities, not even athletics. I was morbidly shy. I felt I was different from everybody else, and entirely undesirable. When I grew up, I married a man who was several years my senior, but I didn't change. My in-laws were a poised and self-confident family. They were everything I should have been, but simply was not. I tried my best to be like them, but I couldn't. Every attempt they made to draw me out of myself only drove me further into my shell. I became nervous and irritable. I avoided all friends. I got so bad, I even dreaded the sound of the doorbell ringing. I was a failure, I knew it, and I was afraid my husband would find out. So whenever we were in public, I tried to be gay and overacted my part. I knew I overacted, and I would be miserable for days afterward. At last I became so unhappy that I could see no point in prolonging my existence. I began to think of suicide. What happened to change this unhappy woman's life? Just a chance remark. A chance remark, Mrs. Allred continued, transformed my whole life. My mother-in-law was talking one day of how she brought her children up, and she said, "No matter what happened, I always insisted on their being themselves." On being themselves. That remark is what did it. In a flash, I realized I had brought all this misery on myself by trying to fit myself into a pattern to which I did not conform. I changed overnight. I started being myself. I tried to make a study of my own personality, tried to find out what I was. I studied my strong points. I learned all I could about colors and styles, and dressed in a way that I felt was becoming to me. I reached out to make friends. I joined an organization, a small one at first, and was petrified with fright when they put me on a program. But each time I spoke, I gained a little courage. It took a long while. But today I have more happiness than I ever dreamed possible. In rearing my own children, I have always taught them the lesson I had to learn from such bitter experience. No matter what happens, always be yourself. This problem of being willing to be yourself is as old as history, says Dr. James Gordon Gilkey, and as universal as human life. This problem of being unwilling to be yourself is the hidden spring behind many neuroses and psychoses and complexes. Angelo Patri has written 13 books and thousands of syndicated newspaper articles on the subject of child training. And he says, "Nobody is so miserable as he who longs to be somebody and something other than the person he is in body and mind." This craving to be something you are not is especially rampant in Hollywood. Sam Wood, one of Hollywood's best-known directors, said the greatest headache he has with aspiring young actors is exactly this problem, to make them be themselves. They all want to be second-rate Lana Turners or third-rate Clark Gables. The public has already had that flavor, Sam Wood keeps telling them. Now it wants something else. Before he started directing such pictures as Goodbye, Mr. Chips, and For Whom the Bell Tolls, Sam Wood spent years in the real estate business, developing sales personalities. He declares that the same principles apply in the business world as in the world of moving pictures. You won't get anywhere playing the ape. You can't be a parrot. Experience has taught me, says Sam Wood, that it's the safest to drop, as quickly as possible, people who pretend to be what they aren't. I asked Paul Boynton, then employment director for a major oil company, what's the biggest mistake people make in applying for jobs. He ought to know. He has interviewed more than 60,000 job seekers, and he's written a book entitled Six Ways to Get a Job. He replied, "The biggest mistake people make in applying for jobs is in not being themselves. Instead of taking their hair down and being completely frank, they often try to give you the answer they think you want. But it doesn't work because nobody wants a phony. Nobody ever wants a counterfeit coin." A certain daughter of a streetcar conductor had to learn that lesson the hard way. She longed to be a singer, but her face was her misfortune. She had a large mouth and protruding buck teeth. When she first sang in public, in a New Jersey nightclub, she tried to pull down her upper lip to cover her teeth. She tried to act glamorous. The results? She made herself ridiculous. She was headed for failure. However, there was a man in this nightclub who heard the girl sing and thought she had talent. "See here," he said bluntly, "I've been watching your performance, and I know what it is you're trying to hide. You're ashamed of your teeth." The girl was embarrassed, but the man continued, "What of it? Is there any particular crime in having buck teeth? Don't try to hide them. Open your mouth, and the audience will love you when they see you're not ashamed. Besides," he said shrewdly, "those teeth you're trying to hide may make your fortune." Cass Daly took his advice and forgot about her teeth. From that time on, she thought only about her audience. She opened her mouth wide and sang with such gusto and enjoyment that she became a top star in movies and radio. Other comedians tried to copy her. The renowned William James was speaking of people who had never found themselves when he declared that the average person develops only 10% of his or her latent mental abilities. "Compared to what we ought to be," he wrote, "we are only half awake. We are making use of only a small part of our physical and mental resources." Stating the thing broadly, human individuals thus live far within their limits. They possess powers of various sorts which they habitually fail to use. You and I have such abilities, so let's not waste a second worrying because we're not like other people. You are something new in this world. Never before, since the beginning of time, has there ever been anybody exactly like you, and never again throughout all the ages to come will there ever be anybody exactly like you again. The science of genetics informs us that you are what you are largely as a result of 23 chromosomes contributed by your father and 23 chromosomes contributed by your mother. These 46 chromosomes comprise everything that determines what you inherit. In each chromosome there may be, says Amram Scheinfeld, anywhere from scores to hundreds of genes, with a single gene, in some cases, able to change the whole life of an individual. Truly, we are fearfully and wonderfully made. Even after your mother and father met and mated, there was only one chance in 300,000 billion that the person who is specifically you would be born. In other words, if you had 300,000 billion brothers and sisters, they might all have been different from you. Is this all guesswork? No, it's a scientific fact. If you'd like to read more about it, consult You and Heredity by Amram Scheinfeld. I can talk with conviction about this subject of being yourself because I feel deeply about it. I know what I'm talking about. I know from bitter and costly experience. To illustrate, when I first came to New York from the cornfields of Missouri, I enrolled in the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. I aspired to be an actor. I had what I thought was a brilliant idea, a shortcut to success, an idea so simple, so foolproof that I couldn't understand why thousands of ambitious people hadn't already discovered it. It was this. I would study how the famous actors of that day, John Drew, Walter Hamden, and Otis Skinner, got their effects. Then I would imitate the best points of each one of them and make myself into a shining, triumphant combination of all of them. How silly! How absurd! I had to waste years of my life imitating other people before it penetrated through my thick Missouri skull that I had to be myself, that I couldn't possibly be anyone else. That distressing experience ought to have taught me a lasting lesson, but it didn't, not me. I was too dumb. I had to learn it all over again. Several years later, I set out to write what I hoped would be the best book on public speaking for businessmen that had ever been written. I had the same foolish idea about writing this book that I had formerly had about acting. I was going to borrow the ideas of a lot of other writers and put them all in one book, a book that would have everything. So I got scores of books on public speaking and spent a year incorporating their ideas into my manuscript. But it finally dawned on me once again that I was playing the fool. This hodgepodge of other men's ideas that I had written was so synthetic, so dull, that no businessman would ever plod through it. so I tossed a year's work into the wastebasket and started all over again. This time, I said to myself, you've got to be Dale Carnegie, with all his faults and limitations. You can't possibly be anybody else. So I quit trying to be a combination of other men, and rolled up my sleeves and did what I should have done in the first place. I wrote a textbook on public speaking out of my own experiences, observations, and convictions as a speaker and a teacher of speaking. I learned for all time, I hope, the lesson that Sir Walter Raleigh learned. I'm not talking about the Sir Walter who threw his coat in the mud for the Queen to step on. I'm talking about the Sir Walter Raleigh who was professor of English literature at Oxford back in 1904. I can't write a book commensurate with Shakespeare, he said, but I can write a book by me. Be yourself. Act on the sage advice that Irving Berlin gave the late George Gershwin. When Berlin and Gershwin first met, Berlin was famous, but Gershwin was a struggling young composer working for $35 a week in Tin Pan Alley. Berlin, impressed by Gershwin's ability, offered Gershwin a job as his musical secretary at almost three times the salary he was then getting. But don't take the job, Berlin advised. If you do, you may develop into a second-rate Berlin. If you insist on being yourself, someday you'll be a first-rate Gershwin. Gershwin heeded that warning and slowly transformed himself into one of the significant American composers of his generation. Charlie Chaplin, Will Rogers, Mary Margaret McBride, Gene Autry, millions of others had to learn the lesson I'm trying to hammer home in this chapter. They had to learn the hard way, just as I did. When Charlie Chaplin first started making films, the director of the picture insisted on Chaplin's imitating a popular German comedian of that day. Charlie Chaplin got nowhere until he acted himself. Bob Hope had a similar experience. He spent years in a singing and dancing act and got nowhere until he began to wisecrack and be himself. Will Rogers twirled a rope in vaudeville for years without saying a word. He got nowhere until he discovered his unique gift for humor and began to talk as he twirled his rope. When Mary Margaret McBride first went on the air, she tried to be an Irish comedian and failed. When she tried to be just what she was, a plain country girl from Missouri, she became one of the most popular radio stars in New York. When Gene Autry tried to get rid of his Texas accent and dress like city boys and claimed he was from New York, people merely laughed behind his back. But when he started twanging his banjo and singing cowboy ballads, Gene Autry started out on a career that made him the world's most popular cowboy, both in pictures and on the radio. You are something new in this world. Be glad of it. Make the most of what nature gave you. In the last analysis, all art is autobiographical. You can sing only what you are. You can paint only what you are. You must be what your experiences, your environment, and your heredity have made you. For better or for worse, you must cultivate your own little garden. For better or for worse, you must play your own little instrument in the orchestra of life. As Emerson said in his essay on self-reliance, there is a time in every man's education when he arrives at the conviction that envy is ignorance, that imitation is suicide, that he must take himself, for better, for worse, as his portion, that though the wide universe is full of good, no kernel of nourishing corn can come to him but which his toil bestowed on that plot of ground which is given him to till. The power which resides in him is new in nature, and none but he knows what that is which he can do, nor does he know until he has tried. And that's the way Emerson said it. But here's the way a poet, the late Douglas Mallock, said it. If you can't be a pine on the top of the hill, be a scrub in the valley, but be the best little scrub by the side of the hill, be a bush if you can't be a tree. If you can't be a bush, be a bit of the grass, and some highway happier make. If you can't be a muskie, then just be a bass, but the liveliest bass in the lake. We can't all be captains, we've got to be crew. There's something for all of us here. There's big work to do, and there's lesser to do, and the task we must do is the near. If you can't be a highway, then just be a trail. If you can't be the sun, be a star. It isn't by size that you win or you fail. Be the best of whatever you are. To cultivate a mental attitude that will bring us peace and freedom from worry, here's Rule 5. Let's not imitate others. Let's find ourselves and be ourselves. Chapter 17. If you have a lemon, make a lemonade. While writing this book, I dropped in one day at the University of Chicago and asked the Chancellor, Robert Maynard Hutchins, how he kept from worrying. He replied, "I've always tried to follow a bit of advice given to me by the late Julius Rosenwald, president of Sears Roebuck and Company. When you have a lemon, make a lemonade." That is what a great educator does. But the fool does the exact opposite. If he finds that life has handed him a lemon, he gives up and says, "I'm beaten. It is fate. I haven't got a chance." Then he proceeds to rail against the world and indulge in an orgy of self-pity. But when the wise man is handed a lemon, he says, "What lesson can I learn from this misfortune? How can I improve my situation? How can I turn this lemon into a lemonade?" After spending a lifetime studying people and their hidden reserves of power, the great psychologist Alfred Adler declared that one of the wonder-filled characteristics of human beings is their power to turn a minus into a plus. Here's an interesting and stimulating story of a woman I know who did just that. Her name is Thelma Thompson. "During the war," she said, as she told me of her experience, "during the war, my husband was stationed at an army training camp near the Mojave Desert in California. I went to live there in order to be near him. I hated the place. I loathed it. I had never before been so miserable. My husband was ordered out on maneuvers in the Mojave Desert, and I was left in a tiny shack alone. The heat was unbearable, 125 degrees in the shade of a cactus. Not a soul to talk to. The wind blew incessantly, and all the food I ate, the very air I breathed, were filled with sand, sand, sand. I was so utterly wretched, so sorry for myself, that I wrote to my parents. I told them I was giving up and coming back home. I said I couldn't stand it one minute longer. I would rather be in jail. My father answered my letter with just two lines that will always sing in my memory, two lines that completely altered my life. Two men looked out from prison bars. One saw the mud, the other saw the stars." I read those two lines over and over. I was ashamed of myself. I made up my mind I would find out what was good in my present situation. I would look for the stars. I made friends with the natives, and their reaction amazed me. When I showed interest in their weaving and pottery, they gave me presents of their favorite pieces, which they'd refused to sell to tourists. I studied the fascinating forms of the cactus and the yuccas and the Joshua trees. I learned about prairie dogs, watched for the desert sunsets, and hunted for seashells that had been left there millions of years ago when the sands of the desert had been an ocean floor. What brought about this astonishing change in me? The Mojave Desert hadn't changed, but I had. I had changed my attitude of mind, and by doing so, I had transformed a wretched experience into the most exciting adventure of my life. I was stimulated and excited by this new world that I'd discovered. I was so excited, I wrote a book about it, a novel that was published under the title Bright Ramparts. I had looked out of my self-created prison and found the stars. Thelma Thompson, you discovered an old truth that the Greeks taught 500 years before Christ was born. The best things are the most difficult. Harry Emerson Fosdick repeated it again in the 20th century. "Happiness is not mostly pleasure, it is mostly victory." Yes, the victory that comes from a sense of achievement, of triumph, of turning our lemons into lemonades. I once visited a happy farmer down in Florida who turned even a poison lemon into lemonade. When he first got his farm, he was discouraged. The land was so wretched he could neither grow fruit nor raise pigs. Nothing thrived there but scrub oaks and rattlesnakes. Then he got his idea. He would turn his liability into an asset. he would make the most of these rattlesnakes. To everyone's amazement, he started canning rattlesnake meat.